This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. Are people with higher levels of life satisfaction more likely to vote for the incumbent government? Dr. Grace Lee, Associate Professor of Economics, and her team have conducted a study that empirically examines the relationship between life satisfaction and incumbent voting in a country that experienced its first turnover of power after more than half a century since its independence. Joining me on the show today to discuss this study is Dr. Grace herself, as well as Dr. Jason Wei, Senior Lecturer at the Department of Econometrics and Business Statistics. Welcome to the show, doctors.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, let's start from the top. Before we really break the study down, right, perhaps you can explain what is your study all about and how was it conducted exactly?
All right, so basically this study was done with Grace and myself and actually two other colleagues as well, Prof. Shanta Vaidilingam from Sunway University and also Dr. Gary Ranger from University of Science Malaysia. So basically this study was about investigating how Malaysians' life satisfaction influenced their voting behavior in GE14 that took place in 2018. And in particular, we wanted to see how their life satisfaction actually influenced incumbent voting. And at the time, the incumbent government was Barisan Nasional, BN. And we also sought to empirically prove that the trust deficit in Barisan Nasional then was the mechanism through which life satisfaction affected the incumbent voting. So actually our work, we are looking beyond the common arguments of ethnicity in the rural urban continuum, which have been the two most salient predictors of electoral outcomes in Malaysian political discourse. So we want to look beyond just ethnicity, we want to look beyond the rural urban continuum debate and start looking at the micro individual level. How does someone who feel about their life, that their well-being, influence whom they vote for? So in terms of how we conducted this research, we actually used survey responses from something called the World Value Survey.
Right.
So this World Value Survey actually comprised of a nationally representative sample of respondents in Malaysia. And the very coincidental thing about it is the Malaysian survey was actually concluded 2 weeks before the election. It consisted about 900 respondents. All right. So being so close, the conclusion of the survey being so close to election date, a lot of the responses actually were reflected in the actual GE14 results as well. So in this survey, there were questions asking respondents which political party would they vote for if a national election were held tomorrow. They were asked, how would they rate their life satisfaction? They'll give a value of 1 if they are completely dissatisfied with their life, or they'll give a value of 10 if they were completely satisfied. They were also asked about the confidence they have in the government, which is used to measure trust. So using these responses, we then undertook statistical modeling to investigate the relationship between these three variables: incumbent voting, trust, and life satisfaction.
Conventional wisdom suggests that people primarily vote, broadly speaking, based on the country's GDP, or as people like to say, the economy, right? If GDP is going well, then you vote for the incumbent. If not, you might lean towards another party. But your research, Dr. Gray, seems to indicate that there are more important issues that people pay attention to than GDP. Would you agree?
The conventional wisdom whereby people vote based on the country's GDP is actually referred to as the retrospective voting, mm-hmm. whereby the ballot boxes actually serve as an opportunity for the voters to evaluate the past performances of the government. And it subsequently allows them to hold the government of the day accountable by keeping them either in the office or voting them out. So through this retrospective behavior, citizens can then incentivize politicians by sanctioning poor behavior, poor performances, and selecting leaders who will govern competently and honestly. However, when it comes to making political choices, an average citizen usually would have a limited grasp of complicated political and economic matters. So mm-hmm. they would rely on a few heuristics. Let me give a couple of examples here. The first is the availability heuristic, whereby voters base their voting decisions on easily recallable pieces of information, such as their recent life satisfaction, rather than a complete evaluation of the entire incumbent performance, that's usually 4 or 5 years. So there's also another heuristic that's called the effect as information heuristic, whereby people use their feelings as a source of information that guides their decision making. So in all, voters might not be knowledgeable enough about political and economic issues, but they know what life has been like during the incumbent's administration. So yes, people are paying attention to more than just GDP, and also because GDP figures do not necessarily trickle down to them. For instance, an increase in the country's GDP does not necessarily be reflected in an increase in their take-home pay.
Right.
So to illustrate this, based on the 2019 Household Income and Expenditure Survey conducted by our Department of Statistics Malaysia, the B40 segment in Malaysia only occupies 16% of the income share, compared to the T20, the top 20 segment, who has a lion's share of the income at close to 50%. So in fact, a growing continent of governments and international organizations are beginning to focus their attention on happiness or subjective well-being of citizens. So some governments now produce national well-being statistics, while many others also go further and use the subjective well-being data and research to inform their policy-making decisions.
Right. And since we're talking about life satisfaction, before we proceed further, how do y'all define life satisfaction?
Life satisfaction is a self-reported measure of well-being that refers to a person's own affective and cognitive evaluation of their lives. Well, it can be understood as the result of satisfaction in many different domains of life, such as job, income, health, family, social relationships, leisure activities, standard of living, country situation, and the like. To measure life satisfaction, we follow the convention of using the responses to the following question. We ask the respondents, all things considered, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days? And the respondents are asked to rate their life satisfaction on a scale from 1 completely dissatisfied to 10 completely satisfied.
Do you think that this sort of shift towards measuring based on life satisfaction is actually a good thing? Because like you mentioned, this whole idea of, you know, oh, the economy is doing well, you know, a lot of people like to say, oh, even, you know, in Malaysia, a lot of people right now, you will have economists saying that, oh, Malaysia's economy is actually still growing and it's doing fine and all of that. But that is not the reality on the ground.
Yeah, definitely. So it's not just narrowly defining the performance of a country by using a nation's GDP. Mm-hmm. In fact, many aspects of life are very important.
Yeah, so actually it's a very good question. It's definitely a positive shift. But actually, if you think about it, I think life satisfaction has always been the underlying thing beneath the surface. It's just that now we're bringing it to the forefront to have an open discussion about this whole idea of well-being. I'm not sure if we actually know, Malaysia actually has a well-being indexed.
Right.
But it's actually not the conventional way of how well-being is actually calculated. It's actually based on metrics like, you know, the number of roads that we have, internet penetration rate. But at the end of the day, life satisfaction is about how one person feels about it. You know, and this whole relationship between life satisfaction and income actually goes back to what we call the Easterlin paradox. And basically, Easterlin, he's a researcher, he actually found that it actually increases in income does not commensurate with improvements in life satisfaction. So you can have the ultra-rich people who are earning a lot of money, but still yet are not satisfied with their life.
Right.
So that's why, you know, that's how the research on well-being actually took off from there. What we call the Easterlin's paradox, where there isn't, where it was actually observed in the US and subsequently in many countries as well, that increases his income does not necessarily correlate with improvements in people's life satisfaction.
Right. So what does international research tell us about the relationship between life satisfaction and incumbent voting?
So actually, this is an emerging area of research. So it's actually regarded as relatively new. And I think this sort of work has always been kind of debated on the theoretical front. But recently, there has been more empirical work done, like scientific evidence to really look into the relationship between these two things. So, and there's actually increasing empirical evidence that the electoral fate of incumbent governments is actually connected to citizens' level of well-being. So one of the first studies done in this area is actually not too long ago. It was actually done in 2017 in the UK, whereby the researchers, they used the British Household Panel Survey. And it actually augmented standard voting models. So actually their model, it looked at GDP, but it also included well-being indicators. And they actually found that the voting intentions for the incumbents were actually very sensitive to the changes in the levels of life satisfaction. And then there's another paper published in 2020, and this author looked at a set of elections in 15 European Union countries since 1973. All right, and they also found that the national average life satisfaction was significantly related to the vote share received by the incumbent government parties or coalitions. Just to give some numbers, you know, a one standard deviation increase in the life satisfaction was associated with a 6 percentage point gain for incumbent parties. Now, if you compare that to economic growth, that same study said this, right? A one standard deviation increase in economic growth only resulted in a 3 percentage point gain for incumbent parties in vote. So happiness actually matters more than economic growth. So there was another paper published in 2021 based on US data, and it actually found that low levels of subjective well-being or life satisfaction actually predicted anti-incumbent voting at the 2012 US election and were predictive of Donald Trump's 2016 electoral victory. The same results hold in Latin America as well. So, you know, most of this international research has been actually focused on established democracies where frequent transfer of powers happen. Therefore, our study is actually one of the first to examine this relationship between life satisfaction and incumbent voting in a country that experienced its first turnover of power after more than half a century since its independence.
It was such a monumental moment, right? I think regardless of which side of the political aisle you swing towards, you know, it was a historic moment because, like you said, Dr. Jason, it was the first time where Malaysia saw a shift in government after, you know, 60 years of independence. What are some of the important and interesting data that you found from your research in Malaysia?
We compared the 2018 data with the 2013 data and also from the World Value Survey. The proportion of respondents evaluating themselves as completely satisfied at a scale of 10 in 2018 was about half only of that in 2013.
Right.
So that was also a slight dip in the average life satisfaction in 2018 compared to 2013. So we found that life satisfaction had a significant impact on whether voters voted for BN. Based on our modeling, our empirical evidence actually showed that an increase in a voter's life satisfaction by 1 point improves the probability of the voter voting for BN by 3.5%.
Right.
So to put this in context, a completely dissatisfied voter would have a 16% chance of voting BN, while a completely satisfied individual is predicted to have a 45% chance of voting BN in GE14. And we also found that the trust deficit recorded was the causal mechanism explaining the relationship between life satisfaction and incumbent voting. In particular, people with greater life satisfaction are more likely to trust the government and therefore are more likely to vote for the government.
Right.
Yeah. Political parties need to begin to look externally at people's life satisfaction and internally, can they be trusted? To win votes, we need to look beyond just the campaign period, right? So Malaysian elections are shaped as much outside of the campaign period as itself as within it. So the mission to win votes should therefore not be a short sprint in the lead up to an election, but rather as a marathon in between general elections. So variables such as life satisfaction and trust take time to build, of course.
Right. I would like to just press further on this idea of life satisfaction, right? What exactly, because Dr. Jason also brought up that even something like income not necessarily directly correlates with life satisfaction. So when we see like this huge let's say, drop in life satisfaction and which influences people to vote one way or another, how do we know what exactly are they unsatisfied about? Because different people may be unsatisfied about different things.
This is actually an important question, especially, you know, after COVID, many things have changed. And in fact, we don't really know the answers. Mm. And we definitely need more research. And in fact, I'm the principal investigator for World Value Survey Malaysia, Wave 8. And we're hoping to start conducting the survey next year. So definitely, we're hoping to shed some more light into this. Because, you know, all the previous survey was done prior COVID, because now after COVID, you know, many things could change, the priorities could change. So, yeah, we don't really know.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting question as to what people are unsatisfied about. And we can only rely on surveys like the World Value Survey to actually understand what's causing their well-being to drop. And as I mentioned at the start as well, that's why the research topic online satisfaction is actually a very vibrant and growing emerging one, because researchers are always trying to find what determines their life satisfaction, what makes them happy in life. And, you know, there's been things like their marital status or divorce or employment. Do they feel connected? Income is one. So income is still very strongly correlated, but it breaks down at a certain point as well. And I think life satisfaction, we probably need a little bit more data on that to actually understand what causes their life satisfaction. And I think it also depends on where they live. I think in Malaysia, we heard about the rural-urban continuum. So for urban voter, you know, what makes them satisfied in life? It could be things as much as democracy. You know, how democratic a country is, their ability to take part in elections. Do they see the election as fair, clean? Whereas for a rural voter, that might not be of the concern. Their well-being probably is determined by things whether I can put food on the table. So it's actually a very wide spectrum of factors that influences one person's life satisfaction. And as Dr. Grace has said, there's no one clear answer to that. And that's where research is really budding in it. But I think as well in Malaysia, we are a little bit limited in our ability to answer that, is because we do not have timely data. You know, even though the World Value Survey, the most recent survey is the Wave 7, the seventh wave, and then the eighth wave is coming up. The interval is once every 5 years. We do not have an agency that collects this sort of data on an annual basis like more developed countries do, like in the European Union, in the UK, in the US. They have annual surveys that do that.
Right.
In Malaysia, we don't have that. So it's very hard for us to track what is making a Malaysian citizen happy.
Right.
All right. And maybe just thinking out of the box a little bit with big data analytics as well, you know, that text mining, sentiment analysis. Malaysians are known to complain and criticize a lot. So Twitter could be a very good source of scraping all the data to actually understand what's affecting their life, you know, their life satisfaction or their happiness. Cost of living is probably one of the bigger things now. All right, chicken prices are soaring, and you know, price of eggs is going to increase in July as well. You know, removal of subsidies for oil as well. I'm sure to a bigger or lesser extent, it's going to impact their life satisfaction.
On the show with me today is Dr. Grace Lee and Dr. Jason Wei, authors of a research paper titled Life Satisfaction and Incumbent Voting, Examining the Mediating Effect of Trust in Government. After a break, I asked them why they think the role of well-being in predicting incumbent voting may work as a double-edged sword in Malaysia. Keep it here on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Grace Lee and Dr. Jason Wei, authors of a research paper titled Life Satisfaction and Incumbent Voting, Examining the Mediating Effect of Trust in Government, which is what we're discussing today. So how did the mediating effect of trust evolve over the five-year gap between GE13 and GE14? Because there was a seismic shift. Although like there were, you know, things were already shifting in sort of a different direction, heading towards GE13 and all, but there was still a, you know, bigger shift, bigger difference when we head towards GE14. So what could be the reason for that?
So actually the reason why we were looking at trust, just to give some context as well. So even though the international research, they established a link between life satisfaction and incumbent voting, the mechanism through which this is achieved was not really well examined. In fact, it's lacking. And that's why we thought, hey, let's consider trust. Because I think if you look at the GE14, there was a lot of issue of trust being raised in the media. So we thought that trust would probably be a very, very crucial variable in explaining this relationship between life satisfaction and incumbent voting. So what we did is we actually compared data from the sixth and the seventh wave of the World Value Survey. So coincidentally, these two surveys were actually completed shortly before GE13 in 2013 and GE14, which happened in 2018. And what we found is the proportion of respondents trusting the government in 2018 was almost half of that in 2013. And the proportion of respondents having absolute distrust in the government in 2018 was 16%. That's triple that in 2013. And the government's average leverage of trust actually dropped from 2.9 out of 4 to 2.43 in 2018. So that represented a 16.2% decline. And what we did is we actually did this mediation analysis for the data for GE14 and GE13. And we actually showed that trust, this variable trust, it mediated the effect of life satisfaction on incumbent voting for GE14, but not in GE13.
Right.
So this mediating effect of trust was very, very unique for GE14, given that circumstances that happened in lead up to GE14. But for us to actually appreciate the implications of this result, we need to establish some context. So for example, in a study by Muhammad Fuad and his colleagues in 2011, they actually concluded that in the 2004 general election, the collective will to see a change in government was lacking. Mm-hmm. And this was despite the Reformasi movement that happened shortly in 1999 after Anwar Ibrahim, he was sacked as Deputy Prime Minister. So in his research, he wrote this, and I quote, "The collective will to embrace potential uncertainties that come with an entirely new government scenario was not strong enough to dislodge Malaysians from their addiction to stability." All right, so Malaysians are addicted to stability. And I actually published another paper in 2017 where I, again, examined the relationship between life satisfaction and incumbent voting. And my research concluded that as well, that Malaysians are addicted to stability. In fact, they want the status quo. They wanted status quo because Malaysians, they want to continue to vote for Barisan Nasional at the time because they wanted to keep the current state of affairs in terms of the desire to preserve political stability and the sense of security that will ensure continued growth of the country. So we're talking about many decades of addiction to stability and the desire for status quo, but this pattern finally broke in GE14, right? There was a dip in people's life satisfaction. There's a very strong mistrust in the government of the day, and that was big enough to jolt the people out of status quo and to vote out a six-decade-old government.
How would you explain people from impoverished backgrounds voting for the incumbent? Because let's say you take Kelantan, for example, which has the second highest poverty rate in the country. What could be the reason behind, let's say, the people of Kelantan electing the incumbent for them, their MPs, which is past MPs? Are they satisfied? Would you say that they are getting some sort of life satisfaction from the incumbent?
Life satisfaction depends on many different domains of life, not just income.
Yep.
And in fact, our data indicate that voters with the highest life satisfaction are not necessarily from the wealthier state. For instance, Kelantan and Terengganu are actually ranked higher than Selangor in terms of life satisfaction.
Right.
So higher than Penang.
Mm.
Yeah, and researchers found that most people tend to make social comparisons. So the income inequality point that I mentioned just now. So living in places with greater income inequality actually tends to reduce happiness. Researchers have found this. And people are less happy when it is easy to see how much better the Jonases are doing. Often we look at our neighbors and make this assumption. So that is one way we decide how good our lives are, right? So according to our survey, we have this question on their perceived income inequality. So it's not the Gini coefficient measured by the statistical department.
Right.
We ask people about the perceived inequality, and the perceived income inequality is actually higher in Selangor than in Kelantan and Trengganu. So this outcome has also has to be viewed in terms of the regional identities.
Mm-hmm.
Kai Oswald, in his study, categorized Malaysia as having four arenas, each with a unique electoral dynamic and vision for the country's political future. So the first is East Malaysia, so comprises of Sabah and Sarawak. Second, peninsula diverse, peninsula districts with more than 50% of non-Malays. And the third, peninsula Malay. So that's the district outside of Kelantan and Terengganu that are greater than 50% Malays. Mm-hmm. And then that's this northeast, all districts in Kelantan and Terengganu. So these four.
As your research points out, right, life satisfaction influences one's trust in a government. And it certainly influences whether people vote against the incumbent or not. I'm wondering, though, if life satisfaction encourages people to go out and vote in the first place. If G14 is an indicator, it seems like people are more likely to participate politically when things aren't going well.
This is an interesting question. Prior to the research on whether life satisfaction affects incumbent voting,
mm-hmm.
earlier research actually sought to examine if life satisfaction influenced political participation, such as showing up to vote. So the answer is yes. Life satisfaction does predict a nation's propensity to vote. For example, in the UK, a 1-point increase in life satisfaction is associated with a 2% increase in the likelihood to vote.
Right.
And in the US, very satisfied individual is 6.7% more likely to vote compared to a completely dissatisfied voter. So does it mean that voters who are not satisfied will not come up to vote? Not necessarily.
Right.
Let's see why. Under the Hatchman framework that's developed in 1970, when the level of dissatisfaction exceeds a certain threshold, distrustful citizens express their discontent by voting for a challenger party. By challenger party, we mean a political party that has never been elected to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And in the eyes of the voter, they remain an untested alternative, right? So the citizens' distrust of the incumbent is expressed by abandoning the incumbent and voting for the challenger party. This happens because the citizens who distrust the government perceive it as incapable of addressing their concerns, and hence they may welcome other options.
Hmm.
So in other words, the challenger party acts as a vehicle for voters to channel their dissatisfaction. So in the context of GE14, this actually happened precisely when voter turnout rate was 82%. Despite GE14 was on a weekday, although it's been granted a public holiday, but still people needed to travel between hometowns and states and the next day, because the next day was a working day. And people still need to go through the inconvenience of applying for leave from work, for instance. So therefore, as you had mentioned, GE14 did seem like a case where people were more likely to participate politically when things aren't going well.
Right.
So however, under the same framework, another alternative could happen.
Hmm.
Voters could actually abstain from voting. This happens when the distrust is too high to the extent that people believe that the political system has broken down.
Right.
Rendering political parties as irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
So this stage was not reached for the Malaysian context in GE14.
Right. And I think that can sort of explain why, you know, the voter turnout in recent elections since GE14 has been, you know, pretty much abysmal, right? And it's getting worse and worse. I think that's a really good point. Now, in your paper, you also mentioned something else that's very interesting that I'd like to perhaps push back a little bit, or, you know, just get your thoughts on it. And you mentioned that, you know, and I quote, the mediating effect of trust suggests that it may be difficult for new new political parties to gain political ground in the short term. But I'm wondering if, you know, this challenges of new political party, especially in a country like Malaysia, does it have to do with trust or the very fact that we are using the first past the post electoral system that pretty much forces people to strategize and vote against the big party that they hate and for the opposing party with the highest chance of winning rather than voting for a party they genuinely like. We see this in the US as well. The electoral college system, it's a winner-takes-all system, pretty much like Malaysia, where for years, any smaller party, they don't get a chance to progress. It's always just Democrats and Republicans, and smaller parties just get buried, right? People don't want to go and vote for them because they're like, they got no chance of winning. It's not because they don't believe in the causes that they're fighting for. How do you make sense of this?
That's actually a very insightful question. The statement that the mediating effect of trust suggests that it's difficult for new political parties to gain political ground. But actually, the statement is possibly true, right? Whether it's due to trust or whether it's due to the first past the post of the current system that Malaysia adopts. This statement is true if, I think, two conditions hold. That number one, you are talking about multi-cornered fights.
Right.
And number two, that voters actually strategize according to the premise which you have just discussed or just described, which is basically the fear of splitting the opposition votes in favor of the incumbent. But I think we have learned some important lessons in GE14. That's actually very hard, very difficult for the electorate to decide whether multi-corner fights will favor the incumbent. The analysts got it wrong for GE14. In fact, in the lead up to GE14, the media reports, we read of analysts saying that, you know, multi-corner fights with PAS would favor the BN because they believe that opposition votes would basically be split between PAS and Pakatan Harapan.
Right.
But subsequent research has actually empirically shown that the multi-corner fights actually disadvantage the BN instead. It did not disadvantage the opposition. And we also need to bear in mind that voters, they do not have access to data and information that political party strategies have. So it's very hard for an average voter like you and me to actually make sense of how would my action influence the eventual outcome. It's very hard for an average voter to comprehend that because it's just a very complex matter. So I would say that the statement about the mediating effect of trust being a disadvantage for new political parties is probably more applicable in straight fights.
Right.
And if the party were going in alone as an independent party. All right, so let's look at an example. So let's look at the Johor by-election. Mm-hmm. All right, so we had the new political party, MUDA. It contested in its maiden election. And the news reported that voters actually expressed reservations about MUDA because it's an unfamiliar party, it's untested. The party was deemed to have inexperience. MUDA also did not have any formal political alliances.
Right.
And that made it hard for voters to vote for them. But let's look at Bersatu. Mm-hmm. Right? Bersatu was officially registered as a political party just 1 year prior to GE14. That's it right. was also a new party. But it was trusted by the electorate because of having Tun Mahathir at the helm, and it was subsequently part of a bigger coalition, Pakatan Harapan. So let's look at another example in GE14. Prabhakaran, he contested as a very young independent candidate in the seat of Batu, previously held by Tien Chua.
Right.
And he was facing Goliath, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he had opponents from, it was actually a four-corner contest. There was himself, Barisan Nasional, Gerakan, and PAS. However, the difference was he had the backing of Tien Chua. He represented PKR and Pakatan Harapan, and he subsequently won the seat. So, you know, just to summarize, I think for new political parties to gain political ground, based on the current system that we have, they will probably need an electorally trusted person at the helm, or if it's part of a tested and trusted coalition, or in another scenario, a change in the first past the post electoral system.
Towards the end of your paper, you wrote something, and I quote, "The role of well-being in predicting incumbent voting may work as a double-edged sword in Malaysia." Why a double-edged sword?
This is a tricky one. I mean, just like fire, you know, fire can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing. And I think it's the same analogy here as well. So yes, we did find that improving the well-being of citizens, it does, there's electoral dividend, right? There's electoral dividend for governments to, you know, kind of invest in the well-being of citizens, and hopefully they would retain incumbency. But Malaysian politics is very unique in the sense that it's actually seen by political scientists as a zero-sum game, whereby the welfare of some is actually achieved at the expense of others. All right, so, you know, even though our study findings show that there are electorate dividends to be gained by focusing on life satisfaction as a whole, but Malaysia has an entrenched clientelism climate, and that may not facilitate such progression, right? I think many of us will be familiar with the slogan, cash is king.
Right. Right?
And that reflects the patronage and the clientelism climate that we have in Malaysia. So in a study, for example, in a study published in 2020, Meredith Wise, she argued that BN was able to stay in power for decades, partly due to his clientelist practices, which interestingly, Pakatan continued after his G14 victory, albeit with different characteristics. In fact, there was this op-ed that actually said under the BN government, the slogan was cash is king. Under the Pakatan government, it was patronage is king. So you can see that, you know, this patronage opportunities, clientelistic initiatives to improve voters' perceptions of their well-being, it will remain embedded in the political strategies as long as voters are acculturated to such norms. All right. And I think if you look at the political situation here in Malaysia, where no political party or coalition has a clear majority or is as dominant as before, or having a huge incumbency advantage, you know, political parties, you know, there might be the inclination to resort to pandering to specific groups at the expense of others to build their support base. And we can see this from history, right? During BN's administration, clientelistic and programmatic initiatives to improve voter perceptions of their well-being, their welfare, have always been factored into their political strategy. But, you know, they have finite resources and, you know, there are those kind of what we call the path-dependent incompatibilities in potential voter bases. So the question has been, given these constraints, which minimum winning coalition of voters should they be targeting with these initiatives? All right. So I think it is from the angle that we made that statement that it could be used as a double-edged sword. You know, even though our findings says that by right, we should try to uplift the well-being of every citizen in the country. But the, you know, the history of the political system in Malaysia where, you know, we have entrenched clientelism and patronage networks, it might actually result, or rather we may see selective targeting and uplifting of specific voter groups of well-being rather than as a whole, the nation's well-being being targeted.
Before we wrap this conversation up, would y'all have some final thoughts or a final message for us? Dr. Grace?
The socioeconomic welfare of the youth needs to be looked into, and it may be a game changer in the upcoming election due to UNDI 18.
Undi 18, that's right.
Right. Now, anyone above 18 can vote, and they are susceptible to economic vulnerabilities and also experience impediments to social mobility. The youth expects deliverables, especially in the economy, which would overflow to their well-being. So this highlights the need for a meaningful engagement and changes in policy outcomes.
Dr. Jason?
My final thoughts is that Malaysia has always been a very interesting or a very popular country of study for a lot of political scientists. You know, in some ways we can be considered like a forefront of political science literature, especially we had the first change of government and that has attracted a lot of attention as well. And I think a lot of people are really looking ahead to G15. You know, a lot of people are probably wondering how would the voter turnout be. I think that has been something that's been expressed, a concern expressed by the opposition as well. And then, of course, as Dr. Grace has mentioned, the Undi 18, that might be a game changer as well, because the youths, you know, I think one of the research studies actually shown that in G14, Barisan Nasional lost the youth vote.
Right.
They absolutely lost the youth vote. And it'd be interesting to see how in G15, whether those age between 18 to 21, how they'll be able to probably, it's really anyone's game. And I think we'll be watching out for this space to see how it actually turns out as well. And I feel that the youth cannot be neglected in a conversation. Their well-being has to be looked into, as Dr. Grace has mentioned, they're the most vulnerable as well. I think from a researcher's point of view, I think we really hope that, you know, the government or even the Department of Health Malaysia can consider actually collecting data, more frequent data about people's well-being, you know, the way to track the movements and actually start using this as a basis for policy formulation. I think it's something worthwhile to look into. You know, that there can be actually more timely policies that can be formulated actually both by the opposition and even by the government. And I think Malaysian politics has to evolve. And I think this is a sentiment that's been echoed by Wong Chin Huat. I think many of us will know him, that we need to evolve into a politics of policies.
Absolutely.
And not a politics, and not politics of identities, but of policies, and not just based on race. Race-based politics as well. And I think with the current political climate, where, as I mentioned, no party has an outright majority, I think people will be looking at what policy ideas would political parties are able to bring to the table, you know, and not so much on protecting certain rights that certain groups might be more vested in as well.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today. That was Dr. Grace Lee, Associate Professor of Economics, and Dr. Jason Wei, Senior Lecturer at the Department of Econometrics and Business Statistics. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.